Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
And we are back, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck, Crossover NBA Podcast, coming to you this week from Boston, Massachusetts, my home, where the Celtics will take on Golden State in Game 3 of the NBA Finals. Howard, welcome back to Boston, my friend.
It is exactly as I recall it from prior Junes in 08 and 10, which is to say sunny, hot, kind of humid, and Dunkin' Donuts every 5 feet.
Gotta love it. Gotta love it.
It's been a while.
There's no such thing as too much Dunkin' Donuts.
I might differ on that, but seeing as how I don't want to spend the next 4 days fighting off angry Bostonians, I will leave the Dunkin' Donuts thing alone. I've been here for less than 24 hours, which means I have not gotten a lobster roll yet, but I plan to spend the next 4 days doing nothing but eating lobster rolls.
I could give you a couple of good recommendations at least. For good lobster roll, you can get great lobster roll in Boston. There's a place down the street from me that has amazing lobster roll. So I'll give you some recommendations there, Howard.
I appreciate that. It is my favorite Boston thing. This is not to diminish any other great Boston things, but I'm a sucker for a lobster roll. What can I tell you?
There you go. All right, Game 3 is on Wednesday night, and let me ask you this simply, Howard. After watching the first two games of this series, which team would you rather be right now going into Game 3?
Look, if it's just simply on the math, on the ledger, I'd rather be Boston. They stole home court. They won Game 1. They put the Warriors on their heels, put doubt in their heads, and left San Francisco with a 1-1 split. And they're the younger team. They're the team that, as we all went in talking about, had none of the finals experience. And they were the ones who got the first blow in. And now they're home for two games. And I've been here for a lot of playoff games and a lot of finals games. And I know what that building looks and sounds like. And it's going to be insane. I brought my earplugs. And like the Warriors have a massive fight on their hands. So just on the scheduling aspect of it, or just the way the thing unfolds, if you're 1-1 going home, you'd rather be that team. That said, the freshest memory we all have is the Warriors completely dismantling the Celtics in Game 2, shutting down Jason Tatum in the second half, not letting any of their shooters get off, Steph having a huge game, so huge that he got to rest the entire fourth quarter because it was such a blowout. And So I think, you know, look, the Warriors have a right to feel pretty good about themselves. The Celtics, that memory is probably lingering. But overall, come on, you got two home games and you got the 1-1 split. So, you could talk yourself into this in either direction.
Yeah, I lean towards the Celtics right now. But it's just a slight lean at this point, Howard, because these third quarters that Boston's been putting out, they're a big-time problem. The Celtics had it in them to rally to win game one after being down 12 at the end of the third quarter. Game two, the lead was just insurmountable, 23 points. It was Sam Hauser time midway through the fourth quarter against Golden State.
Sam Hauser, who the second he checked in and I looked down and I can actually see a person named Hauser with a jersey that says Hauser, and I'm still thinking who he play for.
Yeah, they're actually, I was thinking about this, and I don't think either one of us have time to do this story, but there should be a story on, like, the other guys with Boston. Like, they go eight deep, maybe nine, I guess, now with Daniel Theis in the mix. But, like, the last four guys or three or four guys on that bench, they're hard to identify.
Kind of random.
Sam Hauser, it's Matt Ryan, it's one of the guys that looks like a Zeller. Like, it just, it doesn't.
There's probably a Zeller and a Plumlee in there, and we don't even know it.
Very anonymous, the back end of that Celtics bench. But look, they rallied to win game one. They couldn't rally to win game two. And these third quarters have become kind of an epidemic for the Celtics. It happened in the Milwaukee series in game three, where they had the doors blown off them in the third quarter of that game. It happened in game one of the Miami series. I don't know. What do you make of these third quarter disasters that the Celtics have experienced? Is it psychological? Do you credit Golden State, which has been a really good third quarter team all season long? Like, what's been going wrong with the Celtics there?
Well, it's definitely a horrible combination for Boston, because the Warriors historically, by which I mean pretty much the last 8 years, I mean, granted they had the two down years there, but when the Warriors have been the Warriors, that is one of their signatures, is just knocking teams out in the third quarter. And you combine that with Boston having a history or recent history of crappy third quarters, that is a really dangerous combination for the Celtics. You know, this is one of those like fun things to kind of like try to drill down on without there. Like, there's no, I don't think there's an objective answer on these things. Why is a team great in the third quarter? Does a coach not give good halftime speeches, or like guys just, are they gassed from the first half? Is it something to do with the rotation? Is it something to do with mindset? Is it psychological? Like, who the hell knows? There's like any answer is going to be totally speculative, I think. Now, I mean, you know this Celtics team very well. You've been around them all season and you're based here. So you might have some insights into what the Celtics believe about their own third quarter stumbles. But I never think that there's an obvious answer on these things. And I do think this is one of those areas where, again, speculatively, a team that has a lot of talent and a lot of confidence and a lot of experience knows that coming out and throwing the first blow, getting in the first blow in the third quarter can help you a lot, right? And so maybe the Warriors, the way that they're built and the experience they have, the way they're geared, maybe it's just such a priority. And maybe the Celtics as a younger team that is winning more on talent, maybe you don't feel that same urgency or like you need to. I don't know. Like, that's where this goes speculatively, but it's all like us psychoanalyzing from the sidelines.
Well, I think it is more psychological than anything else, because it's kind of become sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy here, because the Celtics keep blowing these third quarters and they keep getting asked about blowing the third quarters and they keep answering the same way. We've got to be more focused, locked in, come out with better intensity. And then they don't do it. I'm thinking that they come out in these third quarters thinking, oh, we got to do it. And then things just kind of go off the rails pretty quickly for them. So I think it's more of a mental approach coming out of the locker room. But you got to give Golden State a lot of credit for some of the adjustments they made in game two. I mean, Steph was Steph. He had a great third quarter, 14 points in that third, played really good defense as well. I thought Draymond changed the tone of the game early on. He brought a level of defensive intensity that really served as a catalyst for this Warriors team. The Warriors made a nice adjustment. Draymond played Jaylen Brown. Jaylen Brown struggled with his shot. That was impactful in this game. And they just overall played a really solid defensive game. What did you make of kind of the way the Warriors adapted going into game two?
Well, you know, listen, some of this wasn't necessarily like they didn't need to do major things, right? They did have a 12-point lead in the fourth quarter of game one, and then they just fell apart from there. But they obviously had done a lot right. They stuck to Jason Tatum a lot in the second half. I was just watching great quick video by our buddy Mo Dakil, who broke down the Warriors' defense on Tatum in that second half of game two. And you could just see how much attention they paid to him, that Wiggins just would not leave him. You know, Draymond took a turn on him at times as well. And, you know, I think the Warriors will be perfectly happy to not shut down Tatum and say, let everybody else beat us, because that's how they ended up getting beat in game one in the fourth quarter. But more that so much comes off of Tatum when he has the ball in his hands, even as a passer now, right? He's become like a really good playmaker. So denying him the ball, denying him much open space with or without the ball, I think maybe chokes off a lot of possibilities for other guys on that team, because those guys are getting open based on, you know, your rotations and your doubles. And so if Wiggins can just stick to him and cut him off and anticipate, fight through screens, and Tatum doesn't have much room to operate, then I think it starts to choke off a lot of other things. And that's the fact. The other thing the Celtics were wringing their hands about from game two is like that they stopped moving the ball, right? Like it started getting too bogged down in one-on-one play or isolation play, guys trying to do too much on their own. Well, that's what a great defense can do to you. And we don't talk about, you know, the Warriors is a great defensive team enough. That's been a calling card again throughout the last 8 years. But you know, and then I think some of this is just, you know, everybody kind of like, ooh, you know, when Draymond says like, oh, you know, implying that the Celtics can't replicate the shooting after game one. Well, they couldn't, because it wasn't a reasonable expectation. They still shot, you know, the three at a good rate, and you know, there's no question about that. But the guys who really, really hurt them in game one couldn't replicate it. And those things tend to be cyclical, right? Like, you know, it's going to come and go. So it wouldn't be surprising at all for those same guys like Horford, White, Marcus Smart to suddenly go off again in game three.
Yeah, the one-on-one stuff is, it's stuff the Celtics have worked really hard to get away from. And I was talking to Ime Udoka over the weekend for a piece on kind of the Celtics turnaround that's going to come out on Wednesday on SI.com. And, you know, that was one of the things he brought up. Like, he knew coming in that Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown were elite players. But a lot of what they got done offensively in years past was the result of one-on-one play. And for 2 months, Udoka and that coaching staff tried to break them of that habit. And they were successful. The second half of the season, the Celtics, like I think since January 1st, like their assist rate was way up. They were great at the hockey assist as well. So they were really moving the ball around in the second half of the year. Game two was kind of a reversion a little bit, both in terms of not moving the ball and turning the ball over, man. Like you can draw a straight line, Howard, between Celtics losses and the number of turnovers. Like when they turn the ball over, they lose. It's as simple as that. They keep the turnovers under like 11 and 12, they tend to win. Over 12, they lose. They had 19 turnovers in game two, which led to 33 points for Miami. And we can discuss the nuances and the subtleties of the game all we want, but if you commit 19 turnovers, 11 of them being live ball turnovers, you're going to lose more often than not. It's as simple as that. So if I'm Boston, I'm thinking to myself, got to win the third quarter, or at least not get destroyed in it, and we got to keep our turnovers somewhere around 10 for the game. If we do that at home, pretty good chance we're going to win because our roster's pretty good.
Yeah, you know, these are both teams with turnover issues and turnover histories, right? And, you know, the Warriors and Steve, you know, Steve Kerr has been you know, fretting about this since the moment he became coach back in 2014. And the Warriors have those moments too. And that, again, was part of their breakdown in game one in the fourth quarter. And both teams are capable of absolutely pouncing and drilling you for it. So it is something to watch. It is especially something to watch when, like, there's this two sides of the coin here, right? You want the ball movement to activate your offense and to keep the defense off balance. But the more passes you throw and the more you're maybe sometimes hyper-conscious about it, that's when you start to get maybe a little careless or you force some things. And, you know, again, there's a psychological element to this too. There's the pressure of the finals. There's the intensity of it all. It affects guys. Like, you know, I can't remember if we talked about this, but just the atmosphere is different at the finals. When you walk in the building, you feel it. When the game, like, you don't have to be a participant in it, and you don't have to have any stakes in it to feel it. It's a different sense in the air, and sometimes that causes you to do things you wouldn't otherwise do, and lose that focus, force the issue a little bit. But I think turnovers are going to be one of those. I haven't, you know, looked at the first two games, but that's one of those indicator stats where you can probably predict who's going to win based on the turnover count.
For the Celtics, it's always an indicator stat. Has been all season long, has been throughout these playoffs. When they throw the ball around, they lose. When they keep it tight, they tend to win. It's pretty much as simple as that. There are other variables. Second chance points hurt them in game one. You know, of course, the third quarters have been a disaster, but Celtics got to keep those turnovers low. Jason Tatum specifically has not had a breakout game in this series. Shot the ball a lot better in game two, but he was, what, minus 36 overall for the game. This was a guy that was one of the best plus-minus player. I think he was the best plus-minus player in the NBA during the regular season. What do you need to see out of Jason Tatum? What should the Celtics ask of Jason Tatum going into this game three?
It's a good question. I tend to think when you get this deep into the playoffs, when you're in the finals, you're going to go as far as your best players take you, right? Like, I don't, like, it's great to see him put up like 13 assists or something, but like, I don't think Jason Tatum having a great game as a distributor is going to be how the Celtics are going to win consistently. Yes, that worked out okay in game one, despite him shooting terribly. He became a playmaker. Okay, fine. But it's not, I don't think it's the path to the championship is Jason Tatum shooting like, you know, 35%, scoring in the teens, but having a lot of assists. I think that's not how they're built. So I think you want him aggressive, but you don't want him over aggressive. You want him to be looking to score and to get going early, but not forcing it, right? This is the balance that every franchise star has to find, especially the ones who are, you know, generally speaking, guards and wings who are the multi-talented, you can score wherever you want, get your shot off wherever you want. You're a solid to great passer. And the responsibility becomes you're going to have the ball in your hands more than anybody else. You've got to figure out when the right time is to shoot and when to move the ball. And so it sounds like this puzzle that you have, but it is like, that's it. Like it's, he has to, you know, find the right level of aggression, but I want him to be aggressive. I want Jason Tatum looking for his shot, and I want him driving, yep, and I want him putting the Warriors on their heels, because I think it opens up so much else for the Celtics.
Yeah, I think he's got to go when he gets the ball. Sometimes Tatum has a habit of kind of holding on to it, surveying the defense. You don't want to give that Warriors defense a chance to, you know, implement what it's going to implement against you, like whether it's drifting over a defender, putting a defender on the backside, all the things they're throwing at Jason Tatum to try to mix him up. I don't know if there's a number of shots I want to see Jason Tatum take, given what the defense is doing. I just want to see him shoot efficiently. He shot pretty efficiently in game two. 6 for 9 from three-point range is a great number. You want to see that if you can duplicate it. Went to the free throw line 8 times. That's a pretty good number for Jason Tatum. He was part of that core that got run over in the third quarter. And if you're Tatum, you've kind of got to be the guy that stops these runs. Like, you've got to be the one that gets aggressive in those moments, gets to the free throw line, gets a bucket, prevents kind of the rock from rolling down the mountain there when your team is playing the way they were playing. But I don't need him to be a 30-point scorer in game three, but if you're the Celtics, you just want him to be efficient and, yeah, just moving the ball around. Maybe not 13 assists, but 7-8 assists. Keep that ball moving and get your guys open looks, and when they get open looks, make those shots. I mean, Al Horford, what do you have, 26 points in game one, 2 in game two. Marcus Smart, 2 points in game two. Derek White, he had, what, 13, but a lot of those were in garbage time and not during the impactful stretch in that third quarter. To me, it's less about Tatum and more about the other guys making more of the shots they made in game one and didn't in game two.
Yeah, but a lot of those guys are also going to need, you know, the shots created for them too. So, you know, those things I think kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, that's probably true. Quickly, what did you make of Draymond Green announcing to the world that he knows he gets refereed differently, that he has preferential treatment. I'm not exactly sure, Howard, that was the best strategy for Draymond, because you're basically announcing to the world that the referees called the game differently with you, which I would think invites referees in this next game to prove him wrong. You know, maybe in the referee's mind, they're not going to give Draymond the benefit of the doubt in certain situations. What did you make of that?
So let's think this through step by step. Draymond has established a reputation, an earned reputation, for talking a lot, talking very aggressively to other players and to referees at times, and then getting technical fouls, right? He's probably among the leaders in the course of his career. And over the course of that, he has almost numbed out everybody to the fact that he's going to do this. And I think he's probably right in that, because referees are somewhat used to it, and this is, by the way, not just him, there are others in this league who have done this too, who you're just so used to seeing them and hearing them yapping all the time at you, or seeing us from a fan's perspective or media perspective, we're seeing them do it, that you can kind of tell, like, they're giving them more latitude. This is just Draymond being Draymond, or Pat Beverly being Pat Beverly, or whoever. You're just going to let it go. And because you don't want to eject guys, and you certainly don't want to eject them at this level. Now, is Draymond taking advantage of that? Quite possibly. Is that kind of what he was hinting at? You came pretty close to it, that he knows they're not going to call the second one, or they're going to try very hard not to. First of all, just real quick, they're right not to. They were right not to do the double tech the other night. It is the finals. You don't tip the balance based on petty stuff. Now, there's a line somewhere.
All right, but what was Marcus Smart doing pulling Draymond back? I would have let him go. I would have shoved him into Jaylen Brown. I mean, like, invite him to take a swing. Stick your jaw out. Say, come on, man.
I mean, credit to him for not wanting things to get violent, yeah, or I whatever. Suppose. I don't know. I don't think things were
not really violent,
anyway,
but, you know, but rising to the level of a technical.
Yeah. But, you know, look, we're there to see the game, and the teams are there to fight for a championship, and it shouldn't come down to who said the wrong thing at the wrong time, or who dropped one too many F-bombs within range of a referee's ear. Like, that's silly. And people rooting for that, or, you know, wanting guys to eject it. Come on, let's have it be about the game. Now, should Draymond comport himself a little differently, a little bit more, with a little more discipline after having one tech already? I mean, if I'm his coach, I'm certainly wishing for that. The Warriors are used to this by now. But let's get back to the psychological part of this. You're Draymond Green. You say a lot. Referees get used to it. So now you get your one tech, and they're reluctant to call the second tech, and you know it. And now you say it out loud, or at least hint at it, imply it, whatever. Even that's kind of psychologically messing with them, because, Chris, you're saying their response might be the next time they're going to say, well, I'm not letting you get away with that. And the league might say, well, don't let him get away with it. No, because then if you toss him the next time, then it's going to be, ah, the league had it out for Draymond for saying this out loud. And so even by that, he's kind of put them in a position where they probably got to think twice before doing it, lest it look like it's retaliation as opposed to based purely on the merits of what just happened.
I don't think they toss him, Howard, but if there was a prop bet on Draymond getting into early foul trouble in game three, I'm betting on it. Like, I'm, you know, I'm not saying he's going to get technical fouls racked up, but if there's a bang-bang play where it looks like Draymond gets a little bit too physical, and by the way, there were some clips circulating on social media of some of Draymond's illegal screens. Like, good Lord, man. Like, he was like a fullback out there half the
time
setting illegal screens.
So he was
screens.
Like Kevin Garnett in about 2008, 2009?
He might have been worse. He might have been worse. I don't quite recall all the illegal screens KG set, but, like, there was one sequence in particular. I forget who posted it on social, but I watched it a bunch of times, where Draymond, I think he set three illegal screens on three different players, like, during the same set play. So I would imagine that's something that Draymond may not get the benefit of the doubt of
sure.
this time. Not the tech.
Well,
I'm sure he's still going to be allowed to roar at referees in the way that he does, but
yeah.
I think they'll have their eye out on some of those types of screens.
Yeah, I mean, listen, illegal screens are probably one of the harder things for referees to keep in check. A lot of stuff happens over the course of every game. That is one of those things.
But the easiest thing, Howard, to make a subjective call on. Like,
sure.
You can say,
also,
like, this, everything's basically an illegal screen at this point.
Right.
Like, nobody's firmly positioned during screens.
Absolutely. But yeah, to your point, it's like the in the NFL where they say, you know, if you want to, you could call holding on every play. You could probably call an illegal screen on every play. And so, yeah, so now all they have to do is keep an eye on him. And, you know, it'll be there if they want to call it. Yeah, I mean, you know, look, fair point. But if the referees were going to, I don't know, first of all, I don't think the referees ever retaliate in that regard, right? Now, there was an old school NBA where referees had kind of a latitude to officiate the game in a way that was, I think, a little different, less uniform, that was driven partially by their own styles and personalities. The NBA has done everything possible over the last 10, 15 years to eliminate all that and make everybody call the game pretty much exactly the same way. And in concert with that, I don't think there's a lot of individual flourishes or personality coming from the refs in that. So this is not the old days of you know, I don't want to name names, but certain referees who were going to come into the game saying, you want to test me? I'll show you who's in charge here. Like, that doesn't happen anymore. That's not today's NBA officials.
I think I know exactly who you're talking about, but we'll not
there's
name
more
names,
than one. You know? There's more.
That's true. But I think I know who you're talking about, and he's been very visible over the years. And we both like him very much.
Yeah, but listen, let's just say this, too. As part of this evolution over the way the NBA has handled officiating, including player conduct and respect for the game rules and all that, there was a zero tolerance policy for a long time there where you could get texts all over the place with some of the stuff that's going on now. We think about Draymond now, and people might want to analogize him to Rasheed Wallace. Rasheed would have fewer texts in this era because he would get away with a lot more because the referees now are, I think, basically taught to let it go, to tolerate a lot more. And in the past, especially with certain guys, certain refs, they would have been teeing you up, bang, bang, immediately. And this generation of players is getting a lot more benefit of the doubt, a lot more cushion.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Let's run through a few other things, non-finals related, that happened this week. Quinn Snyder out as head coach of the Utah Jazz, stepping down from his position. Surprised by Snyder leaving Utah?
No, this has been a rumor circulating in coaching circles for months, going back to at least midseason. Our buddy Mark Stein reported it on his Substack long ago that this was something to keep an eye on, to the point where Quinn Snyder actually ended up holding an entire press conference to address it one day. I don't know if it was February, March, somewhere in there. So I don't think anybody in the league is surprised. I think the question is more about, you know, what's driving this? And what does it mean for the Jazz? And I'm not sure we have clear answers on any of that. We you know, maybe we'll speculate a little bit, but it's certainly not a great sign, Chris. Quinn Snyder has shown himself to be one of the better coaches in the NBA. He is at least as much a part of this era of, however you want to define it, right? But this has been a successful era. No, not a championship. No, not a conference finals. No, not a lot of playoff success. But the Jazz have been revived in a way that you know, since the Malone-Stockton days, it's been fits and starts. This was a really good, respectable version of the Jazz. Quinn Snyder's the one who instituted all the defensive principles that made them an elite defensive team. Rudy Gobert, of course, is the one who carries that out, by and large. Donovan Mitchell. And those, you know, those are two great picks that they made later in the first round. And they've built smartly around them. But Quinn Snyder has been part and parcel of all this success. And for him to be gone, you can't help but look at that as a certain sign of instability. And when you pair that with all the rumblings about locker room issues and issues between players there, a lot of palace intrigue with their front office over the last couple of years, you have to wonder where this is heading.
Yeah. I'd been speaking to people within that organization for several weeks now as Snyder's future was up in the air. And the sense I got was that Quinn believed that he had taken this team as far as he could, that his voice was no longer resonating as strongly with this group as it once did, which happens, you know, with teams when you have a coach that's been around for a long time. Hell, the Celtics are a great example of it. Brad Stevens, highly successful as a head coach. This Celtics team is not in the finals if Ime Udoka is not the head coach. So oftentimes a new voice can be needed. A lot of people are trying to position this as Quinn versus Donovan Mitchell. I don't think there's animosity between Quinn Snyder and Donovan Mitchell. I do think that Quinn believed he was no longer getting through to Donovan Mitchell. That he didn't, that again, his voice didn't have the same impact with Mitchell that it once did. So he just, look, he just felt like it was time. He'll coach again, probably as early as next season. He's not going to be in the mix, I don't think, for the Charlotte job, which is in the final stages of its interview process. People I talked to that know Quinn believe he's going to keep an eye on San Antonio. That's a job that could interest him if and when Greg Popovich decides to step down. Another spot, Oklahoma City. Now, they've got a coach right now, but if this season doesn't go the way the Thunder want it to go, it would not surprise people around the league to see Quinn Snyder in Oklahoma City. He's got a relationship with Sam Presti that goes back a little ways. So there'll be a lot of good options for Quinn Snyder moving forward. Now, you mentioned the roster. I don't know what's going to happen to it. I Danny Ainge, look, I don't think he's actively looking to trade Donovan Mitchell at this point. I do believe, and this is just knowing Danny Ainge for as long as I have, if somebody comes at him with a Godfather-type offer, he's going to trade him. He will. It's simple as that. And, you know, look, use the Knicks as an example. Could R.J. Barrett plus a couple of first-round picks plus swap rights, I don't know, whatever the package may look like, that could get a deal done. I think Danny Ainge probably realizes exactly what Quinn Snyder realizes, that this team may have plateaued at this point. And just adding pieces around it is not going to push them to the level of Golden State, of Phoenix, of Memphis, of all the other teams that are coming up, whether it's New Orleans, the Clippers are going to be a lot better next year. Denver is going to get their guys back. It is a gauntlet in the Western Conference. And while Mitchell and Gobert are really good players, Mike Conley's going to be a year older. You're not going to just add a whole bunch of defensive weapons overnight to the perimeter. I just think this team is ripe for a complete teardown at this point. And look, Danny's very familiar with how that process goes.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the trickier spots for an NBA team to be in, Chris, because for a 3-4 year run there, it looks like you're knocking on the door and it's like, oh, a break here, a break there, or maybe one player away, one shooter away, one perimeter defender away or whatever, and you think, and we're right there and maybe we can make it. So making the determination of whether you're actually truly on the cusp and have a shot and are still a player away or a move away versus, you know what, maybe we've maxed out with this group and it's time actually to take a step back to go forward. And you laid it out perfectly. I mean, the West is only getting tougher next season. In fact, if anything, this was kind of a down year for the West at the top. And it's really crowded, and those teams are really talented. And while we every year see some unexpected stuff happen, you know, look, we all thought the Lakers might struggle with Westbrook there, but we didn't think they were going to be this bad. Some things happen that you can't expect, but not all these teams are going away. And as you point out, some of them, like the Clippers and Nuggets, are going to come roaring back after injuries. And the Mavericks will do something to add to Luka. You know, they're not going to stand pat. The Grizzlies will keep pushing forward. The Pelicans are coming. Like, I'm not saying the Pelicans are going to leapfrog the Jazz tomorrow, but maybe. there's just a lot of there's a lot of talented teams who are right in that range. And if you're the Jazz, you have to consider whether it's time to take a step back instead, whether you've gone as far as you possibly can with Mitchell and Gobert as your two pillars. And as you note, Danny Ainge has a history of no sentimentality, not loyal to anybody. Traded Isaiah Thomas after Isaiah Thomas's most memorable season of his career and after a lot of other things happened along the way. Like, Danny Ainge is going to do whatever's necessary. Now, Danny Ainge has that whatever weird title where he's like, he's not technically head of basketball operations, but like
he is,
but
he is.
He's there for a reason.
He was the one sitting next to Quinn Snyder.
Yeah.
You know,
he's
in charge.
He's there for a reason.
And look, as I can tell you this about Danny, making the playoffs doesn't work for him. Like, being like a one and done team doesn't work for him. A two and done team. If he did, he would have kept Pierce, kept Rondo, kept KG, finished out a couple of years, been a playoff team every single year and been sentimental about it. He didn't. And look, he can point to the blueprint. Like, it took 10 years, but the Celtics got back to the finals and are now well-positioned to be a championship contender for years to come. One other thing I want to get to. Darvin Ham had his introductory press conference with the Lakers this week. And predictably, he was asked about Russell Westbrook. And, you know, look, Darvin, I know he has to say all these things and has to be laudatory and praise Russell Westbrook, but he's talking about getting Westbrook back to a level where he's an elite defensive player. I don't know that level ever really existed. He's talking about Westbrook playing more off the ball. That's exactly what Frank Vogel wanted him to do when Frank Vogel inherited him in the trade last season. I've said all along, Darvin Ham is the right guy for that job, whether you're coaching to win now or you're coaching to rebuild for the future. But nothing he said at that press conference makes me optimistic that he can make it work with Russell Westbrook. I feel like the Lakers are going to go into training camp, and once the season starts, they're going to run into the exact same problems they had last year. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, listen, we talked about this, was it last pod, two pods ago, whenever it was, about when we knew that Ham was going to be the guy, and I said, and I'll say it again, it's not that coaching doesn't matter. It's not that I don't think Darvin Ham will be a good coach. It's not that I don't think that he was the right hire or anything else. But I do think that the coach of the Lakers is almost irrelevant until they figure out the roster. And they have not figured out the roster. Nothing has changed about the roster. The roster is broken. A healthy LeBron for most of 82 games would help. A healthy Anthony Davis for most of 82 games would surely help.
You're back in the playoffs if both those guys
sure,
are healthy. There's no doubt about that.
Yes, you solve one problem just with health. But I mean, that's not an assumption you can make that readily either because of LeBron's age and Anthony Davis's long, tortured injury history. Your best bet, if you're going to go into a season thinking that you may not have one or both of them all the time, is to maybe have a guy like Russell Westbrook, if it were Westbrook from 5 or 10 years ago. But we saw over and over and over again that when it was Westbrook with just one of those guys, or Westbrook by himself, he could not elevate a team. He can't do it anymore. Now, if you want to say, well, that's partially because of the roster construction and he didn't have enough shooters around him because he's not a shooter. Okay, fine. That still goes back to my main point about the Lakers, which is coaching is not the solution. They have to fix the roster. They have so much work to do with this roster, all of which is obscured by, and this happens with every team, right? You lose, you fire the coach, you bring in a new guy, and on day one, everything is just the celebration of the new guy and all their great ideas and all their positivity. And Darvin Ham had a fantastic press conference. They still have to go fix the roster. And if I'm Darvin Ham, that's what I'm telling them during the interview process. And it's what we're working on the second that press conference ends is, by the way, guys, let's get to it. Let's start figuring this out. Now, does he truly believe as passionately privately as he said publicly about Westbrook being essential still and being vital and revivable? I don't know. I do know that Russell Westbrook is turning 34 in November. I do know that he's coming off pretty much the worst season of his career. I do know that he didn't defend in his prime, so it's unreasonable to expect he's going to defend now, and that he...
That was the big one, Howard. Like, you know, get him back to being...
Yeah, that was weird. Did he use back to?
Like, I was texting some people in Oklahoma, like, did I miss something? Was he ever a great defensive player? He was athletic, and he could make some great defensive plays because of that, yeah. But as far as a lockdown defender, he was never that, and... Look, he's saying everything you have to say in that moment, but none of it is really believable right now. And you still have to wonder if it's not in the Lakers' best interest, if they can't find a trade for Westbrook to start the season, to just part ways with him. Like, maybe you go through training camp and you see what you have here, but if Westbrook, you know, doesn't work on the weak parts of his game, which is playing off ball and shooting three-point shots, I'm not sure what value he brings to a team that has LeBron and AD, because AD... You know, maybe he gets better as a shooter, but he's not an overly reliable three-point threat. LeBron has gotten a lot better from three-point range, but you talk about adding three-point shooters to that team, like, they don't grow on trees. Like, everybody wants to add a three-point shooter to their team. Everybody wants to add defensive versatility to their team. Everyone wants to add wing, springy, long, 6'7", 6'8" guys. The Lakers are going to be competing for these type of guys on the open market, and they don't have any cap space to really make any kind of credible offers to some of the top guys. It's great that Darvin Ham's getting an opportunity. I don't see this being a changed team once the season starts.
No, and look, we're talking about this in the first week of June, right? So we have the draft coming up. We have free agency coming up. There's, you know, the work that's going to be done is yet to come. So, you know, I agree with your assessment pending what happens in the real offseason here, right? Like, let's give them that opportunity, right? Let's see what happens. Let's see. Do Rob Pelinka and his staff recognize just how much work there is to do and how much, you know, how messed up this roster really is? We'll find out soon.
Well, in a way, Howard, they have no choice in a way, right? Like, half the roster is a free agent. Like, yeah, they signed so many minimum guys, yeah, that you're going to have to either bring those guys back, which they don't want to do, or find new minimum guys that'll play there. And, like, the minimum guys that are available, they're like the Dwight Howards, like the guys that aren't as versatile as teams are. Look, you look at this finals matchup, versatility matters. The Celtics, with all their versatility on defense, the Warriors, Looney plays multiple positions, Andrew Wiggins plays multiple positions, Draymond Green plays multiple positions. Those are the kind of guys the Lakers need, and they're really hard to find. And they don't have the draft capital to go out and find them that way in free agency. It just feels like it's too tough.
Yes, and they also don't have a lot to trade, right? They've, you know, they're going to get another pick that they can trade after this draft and everything. Like, they've got some future picks, but they don't want to obviously waste them just to offload Westbrook. But I still think that that's probably the move, because now is all that matters. On the other hand, if you don't use it to offload Westbrook, but you can use those picks to trade for some veteran help, I don't think they're in position to get Jeremy Grant. I think if Jeremy Grant becomes available, if the Pistons decide to move him, there are going to be teams that make much better offers, starting with
so many better offers. Starting, like the Talen Horton Tucker, Kendrick Nunn combination the Lakers were dangling to other teams. Like, Kendrick Nunn will be back, but he hasn't played in a year.
Yeah, there's just nothing there. So I don't know how they get this done. But that, to me, is still the biggest question of the Lakers offseason. I'm genuinely curious to see what do they do starting on draft day. Not so much about the draft itself, but whether that's a time for them to start making some trade moves. What do they do between the draft and into the early days of free agency? That will tell us everything we need to know about whether the Lakers have a chance to have a revival next season.
Yeah, I'm at this point not counting on it, but you're right. Give the front office a chance, see what they can do, and see if they can bring in the type of players that, you know, maximize what LeBron and AD do. Howard, we'll talk offline about lobster roll recommendations, and I will see you in the press seats on Wednesday night for Game 3.
Can't wait.
At Kroger Pharmacy, Care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.